Hello and welcome to another episode of Q&A, GCN's Queer and Alternative Podcast. I'm your host, my name is Brian Finnegan, and today I'm with the legendary Sarah Shulman. Sarah has worked for decades writing novels, plays, articles and books that are, in her words, often received by publishers or producers as not the kind of thing we do, and the majority of which feature queer characters and themes. Her 9 novels so far, there's a 10th out this year, 6 non-fiction books, 5 plays, they have all reflected her passion for social justice, which has also played out in decades of activism, particularly around HIV and AIDS. Sarah has also worked as a film producer, most notably on the brilliant documentary United in Anger, A History of ACT UP, and she was a founding member of the Lesbian Avengers. She first came to my attention as one of the activists who were routinely arrested in the 90s and 2000s at the St. Patrick's Day parade in New York City, fighting on behalf of the Irish by marching and carrying LGBT placards when they were banned. And I'm very glad to meet her now. So welcome, Sarah, to
Hi,
the Q&A studio.
Thank you for having me.
You're a little bit jet-lagged. You arrived
in
today.
I'm super jet-lagged, but maybe that'll make me freer.
Free is good. So there's two, I mean, obviously there's two concurrent strands to your life's work, and they are writing and activism. So maybe we start with which came first.
Oh, I started writing when I was 6. Okay. So that's probably, I would say that probably came first.
And when did you start being an activist?
Well, you know, so I was born in 1958, right, in New York City. So my childhood was the 60s. And my mother was a social worker, and she was very much against the war in Vietnam. So she used to take us on the bus of the Social Workers Union to Washington, D.C. on these cold days.
Wow.
To protest. So I think that, I guess I was born into it in that regard.
And so it kind of concurrently developed as a writer. What was the first thing you wrote when you were 6, do you remember?
I wrote, "When I grow up, I will write books."
Okay.
I wrote that down, yeah.
Wow, so you knew you're...
I really knew.
You're very clear. Have you always been that clear-minded about everything?
No, but that was something, I think, you know, it's funny because I am from this Holocaust family, and so I'm in that generation of children who were handed the Diary of Anne Frank at very young ages.
Okay.
And I think that the message that I got from it was that girls could be writers. And I think a lot of girls my age started keeping diaries because they read that book. So that's probably where I got the idea.
And the activism, your activist mind just bled into writing, or did you decide to set out and...
Well, I was, there was never a time I didn't know about the Holocaust. I always knew about it. And because my grandmother, who lived with us, had 2 brothers and 2 sisters who were exterminated. So it was very close. And so my whole, you know, introduction to being a person was this discourse about how other people stood by and they didn't do anything, you know, this type of thing. So that was like indoctrinated in me from the beginning.
Not to be a bystander.
Right.
Okay.
Which I took very literally.
You did.
To a fault at an extreme.
And continued to do so.
Yeah.
You very much identify as a queer writer.
As opposed to what?
Well, I suppose a lot of queer writers identify as queer and then writers.
Oh, I see.
You've overtly said, "I am a queer writer." I want to talk about...
It's a little coy, I think.
Is
that,
it?
That other game. Yeah.
The other game of being a queer and then a writer
yeah.
in a second. Well, tell me about being a queer writer in a, I suppose, heteronormative industry.
Well, I mean, I think that the problem was being a lesbian writer, really,
okay.
because as my friend Irvashi Vad said, lesbian content is the kiss of death professionally. But, you know, I didn't really realize that when I made that decision with my very first book in 1984 when I was 24. It came out in 84, but I wrote it in 82, and I wrote a lesbian detective novel. I think it was the 3rd lesbian detective novel in the world at the time. But I didn't think, oh, this is going to marginalize me for the rest of my life. I just thought, oh. And I guess I thought any day now, this is all going to be normal. And it just never happened. But there's, I think, about a 30-year gap, because this novel I wrote in 88 called After Dolores
yes.
is finally now like reaching a certain kind of a normal mainstream audience 30 years later. So
how has that happened? Has it been reissued, or
There's interest in it. Like I was contacted by a group of young women who said, "Oh, it's the 30th anniversary of After Dolores," and I didn't even realize that. And they organized this public event where we discussed the book, and all these people came, and it was remarkable because I remember writing it. I remember I wrote it on a typewriter sitting on the floor of my apartment, and I remember I was a waitress at the time, and I was like, why am I doing this? And I thought, well, maybe in the future someone will like this, and it turned out to be true. Yes. Which is really kind of amazing, you know, and incredible. And now, like, people are interested in making it into a movie.
I know,
finally.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah, it's very cinematic. I mean, when it was first written, people were like, this should be a movie, but it just never...
It never hit the mainstream, really.
It was too lesbian, yeah.
Is that still a problem? Is there books that are too lesbian?
I think any lesbian book is too lesbian still, because, I mean, in the States, at least, we've never had the kind of thing that's happened over here where lesbian writers can be part of the literature. So there's no lesbian book... in the United States that's been a bestseller since Patricia Highsmith in the 50s with The Price of Salt.
So this hasn't really happened over here either. I mean, Emma Donoghue is possibly the
Emma Donoghue is exactly.
But her novel is not the one that catapulted her into world, you know.
But she has those other books that are sort of where she takes classic forms.
Yes.
And then redoes them as lesbian
novels. And she began with the lesbian coming of age novel in the 90s, Stir Fry. Let's move on to activism for a while. And you talked in the current issue of GCN, there's an interview with you that Roisin McVeigh did, a great interview. And you talk about activism in the age of the hashtag and the T-shirt. The hashtag and the T-shirt worked very well for us during the marriage equality referendum campaign.
Yes.
And we're about to go into an extremely difficult and, I suppose, hard-fought referendum in Ireland on bodily autonomy for women. It's a hard fight. Historically, it's going to be really, based on our history, it's going to be a really hard fight for us. How do you think it could be won?
I certainly don't have the answer, because in the United States, as you probably know, we only had full abortion rights from 73 to 79.
Yes.
So ever since then, it's been basically only if you can pay and only if you can get to a place where it's offered. So we're not a good example of success, because we've had this problem of religious fanatics. And, you know, they're the people who've put Donald Trump in office right now. So... you know, the idea that there's a very significant number of people out there who have a very fundamentalist interpretation of their concept of Christianity, and in other places it's other religions that dominate. And that's something that we've never been able to overcome. So
ACT UP in a way overcame that, you know, the movement of ACT UP, the way ACT UP worked out. It was successful in its.
It was successful, but the enemy was not religion. The problem was pharmaceutical companies who didn't think that they could make a profit. They were originally, when you look back at the early days, they were recycling failed cancer drugs that they had patents for. And they scored big with AZT, which was the largest profit-making pharmaceutical in history. But now we know that AZT only worked for 12 days.
Yes.
But we had large numbers of people taking it at a very high dose, and Burroughs Wellcome was making a fortune. But in order to get them to do research on medications that were appropriate to the way that AIDS functioned, we had to force them through direct action activist campaigns. So, but it wasn't, our problem was not God. It was the dollar.
But I think maybe God and the dollar are somehow aligned, in that God's always part of the mix. You know, you had a president at the time who was, you know, conservative, right wing, you know, based on a Christian idea.
Yeah, but when he was governor of California, Ronald Reagan, we're talking about,
yes.
He was pro-choice. He only switched his position because at that 1980 is when the Republican Party made a coalition with religious right, and brought them into the party, and now they control the party. But yeah, that was, he was just being a cynical politician.
We have ACT UP Dublin, very active at the moment around PrEP and,
What are they? What is their fight about?
Well, their fight is to get it made available.
It's on insurance.
So are made affordably available. We only had it introduced really into pharmacies last December, and before that, people were illegally, or have been, and still, I suppose, are illegally importing it online.
Oh, wow.
What do you think of PrEP? Do you think it's the game changer that everyone says?
Well, looking at it as an American, I have a particular viewpoint because we don't have health insurance, right? Culturally, PrEP is like the birth control pill. You know, it's something that makes people freer and also may have long-term consequences that we don't understand.
Yes.
But socially, it's certainly liberating, and I understand it and it makes sense. But in terms of the politics of health, you know, since we now have standard of care for HIV disease, where if people have got appropriate treatment, they become not infectious. So if everyone who was infected had standard of care, nobody would be infectious. So there would be no need for PrEP, or very minimal need. In the United States, only 1/3 of people who are infected have the standard of care.
Okay.
So it's the lack of health care is what keeps the market open for PrEP, which is made by a company called Gilead.
Yes,
we're back
we
to
all
God.
Know. Yes.
You know, so in a sense, they're making money off the fact that people don't have health care.
Okay. And talk to me about stigma. I read that you said it's a never-ending thing, HIV stigma.
Well, you know, I've been covering AIDS since 1982.
Yes,
so I've been
that's
on
a never-ending story.
A very long time, yes. And it's been a fascinating ride. I mean, it's so interesting. But what's happening now is that we have this global phenomena of HIV criminalization. I don't know if it's hit Ireland, but it's all over the world. And it's like, it's these kind of very punitive punitive laws saying that people who are positive are mandated by law to disclose their status to their sexual partners.
Yes.
Now, the thing is, if you're on meds, you're not infectious. Or if you use a condom, no one's going to be infected. But these laws don't care about that. It's entirely about stigmatizing people with HIV. And it's so interesting because at this stage of the game, if you have access to care, HIV is not the worst thing that can happen to you. There's a lot of other diseases that are a lot more scary than HIV. But the stigma never ends. Because in the minds of the public, it's queered forever, even though most people with HIV are straight. Because it's associated with anal sex and intravenous drug use. And it's become this incredibly malleable political tool. Mm. Like I did a very in-depth study of HIV criminalization in Canada, which has one of the worst laws in the world. Like, don't be fooled by Canada. I know everyone thinks they're so cool. They're not. It's a neoliberal facade. But in my most recent book, Conflict is Not Abuse, I have a very in-depth look at the Canadian system. But they have 250 people who've been incarcerated under this law, who have not infected anybody.
They just didn't disclose.
They didn't disclose, and their partners turned them in. And, you know, as a journalist, of course, my first question was, who are these people? So when you look at the population, or when I looked at it, 50% were Black. Now, there's no Black people in Canada, okay? It's like 2% of the population.
Yeah.
So obviously, you see that it's a racist, anti-immigrant construction. But even more so, it changes the self-concept of the HIV negative person. Because for 30 years, the negative person has been a person who we define as someone who has the responsibility to keep themselves negative. And what these criminalization laws do is the government says to the negative person, you are not responsible. You are potentially criminally wronged. You know, they're just manipulating the whole trend towards victimization identity that people with power now are embracing.
Yes.
And so they created a whole new class of people, HIV negative people, who now have the power to incarcerate a whole other class, HIV positive people. And every time you create a new class of people who can be incarcerated, you're enhancing the power of the state, basically. So that's, you know, that's where we see how it's used. And then you have some crazy examples like Taiwan. I was in Taiwan, and they have a law that people who are positive can't have sex with each other. It is against the law. Because there are these, when you go around the world, Jim Hubbard and I made this film, United in Anger, yes. A History of ACT UP, and we showed it all over the world. And so we met people with HIV all over the world. And when you start to have an experience like that, you see that the people who are making the policies at the top don't know anything. And they're making ridiculous choices. We were in Russia, where most people with HIV are straight because it's connected more to drug abuse.
Yes.
And, you know, now with Truvada, people are not born positive anymore. There's a whole generation of people who were born HIV positive, but no longer, because if a positive woman is pregnant and she takes Truvada, her child is born negative. But in Russia, where the government orders all the medications, they don't order Truvada. So we met these women, you know, who are straight and who are positive, who are like, how can we get Truvada so we can have children?
Oh, my gosh.
You know, and you're just like, the people on top are totally misinformed.
And they make, that's crazy decisions. So two positive people can't sleep together in
Taiwan.
Or can't have sex in Taiwan. What's the logic?
Well, they have a twisted logic where they believe in this very old myth that has been disproved about the super virus.
Yeah.
That if, you know, there have been so many myths about AIDS from the beginning, starting with the cluster theory. And when, you know, there's a really interesting book out now by this guy named Richard Mackey, who lives in England. It's called Patient Zero. And he's a young guy who's revisiting the myth of Patient Zero, yes. Who those of us who are older remember was a Quebecois airline steward named Gaetan Dugas, who was blamed by the U.S. government for infecting the United States with HIV. And this young guy went back. He's a scholar. So he's from this new generation of AIDS scholars who didn't live through the epidemic, who were looking at it entirely through documents. And he went back, and he went back to the handwritten... So Gaetan Dugas was called Patient Zero. He went back to the handwritten notes of the Center for Disease Control in 1981 and realized that he wasn't Patient Zero. He was Patient O. There was Patient A, B, C, D, E, and somebody had recopied the O, and someone had...
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
So Patient A is...
Well, there... They thought that because he reported the most contacts, that he was the person who was, quote, spreading the virus. But actually, it turns out he was just the only one who cooperated and told the truth and gave his actual contacts. And so he got blamed for this and was blamed.
Yeah.
Now we know that in 1981, when the New York Times reported 7 cases of gay cancer, that actually at that point already 200,000 people were infected.
Talk to me, so let's go on to conflict is not abuse.
Okay.
and this idea of victimhood and the people in power being the victims and the actual victims not being the victims.
And we hear this in the, you know, United States is, as we know, is in the middle of a national cataclysm from which we will probably never emerge. And it's a mind-boggling experience to be going through it. But one of the things that's happening is that every day our horrible criminal president is talking about what a victim he is, how it's a witch hunt and he's being abused and it's so sad and it's so unfair. And this is very common in our historic moment that people who are perpetrators use the language of victimology to describe themselves. And one of the big examples that I give in my book is the Israeli state, which is constantly describing themselves as abused, threatened, and under attack, when they're this enormous military power that has, you know, subjugated an entire other people, the Palestinians, but they discuss themselves in victim terms.
Yep.
And we see it in intimate relationships as well. There's a confusion now. People feel that if they're upset, if they're truly upset and they're truly in pain, it means that they're being victimized. And that's not the case. You know, we can feel absolutely devastated and in turmoil and have no idea of how to make our lives better. But it doesn't mean that it's being caused by another person. Sometimes what's happening is conflict, which is like a power struggle in which we are participating in escalating things because we don't know any better way. And yet we see it as ourselves being victimized.
Yeah.
There is, of course, real abuse, which is power over. you know, and that we see all the time, people who are psychologically and physically completely controlled by another person, people who are subjected to systemic racism or sexism, you know, that's abuse. But the word abuse has become very much overused as a way of abdicating responsibility or opportunity to take responsibility for our participation instead of escalating. And every time we escalate, as I try to show in my book, we enhance the power of the state.
So to even in our personal relationships, we're enhancing that power dynamic.
Yeah, like in the States, you know, we're having a crisis about police violence. And we're seeing often that you see this kind of thing. Somebody has a fight with their son. They call the police. The police come. They kill the son. You know, there's this performance now of calling the police, which means that I am pure and innocent. I am a victim. And therefore, I must call the police. When actually sometimes it's part of just escalating or abdicating responsibility.
It's an escalating conflict. So you just, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to get out of this or I'm going to...
Yeah. Claim. And of course, the police are the least capable people of solving problems. In the book, I cite a study from the LGBTQI Anti-Violence Project that showed that in half of all domestic violence cases of same-sex couples, the police arrest the wrong party. Because when the people are the two same gender, they can't tell who the perpetrator is. So they go based on who's butch or who's of color or who's an immigrant or who's HIV positive or who's not a mother. And that's the person they arrest.
Amazing. And they also, I suppose the police also cry victim too.
Of course. They justify all of these racist killings by their own anxiety, which they claim, you know, they pretend is being caused by external forces, but it's actually internal.
Okay. Let's talk about then the oppressed becoming the oppressor in relation to all of this. The idea of, you know, the oppressed gay white man becoming the oppressor and moving to the right wing.
Yeah.
You know, as we've seen quite a lot around across Europe.
Well, I mean, this theorist named Jasbir Poor called this homo nationalism, and I think that word is very helpful. But that, you know, there in my lifetime, certainly gay people have been profoundly oppressed, and we were allowed to die in enormous numbers and to suffer because our lives didn't matter. And that exists in my memory. However, in recent time, there's been a certain kind of white reconciliation in which white gay people, especially men, have been sort of invited back into whiteness and have been accepted into certain kinds of power structures in which they're now identifying with the government. And we're seeing more and more white gay people, especially in Europe, joining racist parties and anti-immigrant, especially anti-Islamic you know, reactionary movements. We've seen alliances with Le Pen and certain sector of white gay French people. We've seen it, especially in the Netherlands, where gay people have all the same rights as straight people, you know. And so this is the new trend. Now, what's interesting is now there's a revival. Like, for example, in New York right now, there's a revival of all of these white gay plays from the oppression period. So right now on Broadway, you can see Boys in the Band and Angels in America and Torch Song Trilogy because it's nostalgia for white gay, when white gay men were oppressed. It's a kind of mask to avoid the fact of all the complicity now, especially in the States where there's so much racism now and there's so much anti-immigrant cruelty. So this nostalgia for our past oppression is a mask. And I know this as a Jewish person who comes from a Holocaust family, you know, to adjust from the idea that in 1945, Jews were the most oppressed people in the world, and that 3 years later, in 1948, we got control of a nation state and subordinated an entire other people. That's a leap that's very hard to internalize, where you go from abject, total oppression to being in a position of dominance over others. And it's of course, because the pain from the early experience never goes away. But there's a way of living in the past that helps us justify cruelty to other people. And certainly white gay people are in that position.
So it's a natural progression from being oppressed to become the oppressor if you're given the circumstances.
If you can enter into whiteness, yes.
Yes.
And Jews have entered into whiteness, and now gay men have entered into whiteness as well.
Homo nationalism and homo normativity.
Yes, they're not the same.
Talk to me about homonormativity.
Well, homonormativity was a term that was coined by Lisa Dugan, who is a professor at New York University. And it was about, she observed that there was a trend of gay people rejecting the gay liberation concept of gay culture, which was an idea that of radicalizing and revolutionizing sexual relationships and community-based relationships, and then abandoning that. And instead moving into a kind of gay version of straight life, so that it was gay marriage, parenthood, nuclear family, which was something that straight people accepted because they recognized it. And it's very interesting when you look at the propaganda campaigns in the States around gay marriage, because none of the poster boys for gay marriage were ever identified as HIV positive. So there was this sort of subtextual argument that gay marriage was going to be the cure to the wildness of gay male sexual culture, in the sense that, there was an assumption that gay marriage was monogamous, which in many cases it's not, but that it was going to be a corrective to AIDS. And all of this was, you know, never stated overtly, but it was implied. And it took place at a time when in gay politics, gay and AIDS became separated. That there was a big emphasis on the fact that Black women, for example, had a very high rate of HIV in the U.S., and AIDS started to be seen as something that affected straight people of color, and it got and the gay community wanted to separate from AIDS, and younger generations disassociated from AIDS, so the two things got really separated, and that's when we got gay marriage. Now we know that the greatest rates of infection are young gay people of color. In fact, one of our most important journalists in the United States, Linda Villarosa, did a story in the New York Times recently showing that HIV rates of Black gay men in the U.S. South are higher than any country in the world. And this is happening at the same time that you have white gay men like David France or Andrew Sullivan saying, "We survived a plague. AIDS is over," because they and their friends are no longer, you know, they are virally suppressed because they're on the drugs. But if you look at people, queer people of color in the United States, that's an absurd statement. So this whitening of AIDS is very, very dangerous and very false.
Yeah, and while you're talking there, I'm thinking about those plays on Broadway, Angels in America, Torch Song Trilogy, The Boys in the Band, and the idea of heteronormativity, that we've kind of progressed in inverted commas to this sense of being part of the mainstream, able to get married in Ireland. You can get married, you can adopt children. There's this sense of being just as good as the heterosexuals, but is that nostalgia? Are those plays part of a nostalgia for being the other?
It's part of that.
Yeah.
It's also because, you know, it takes a lot of money to get a play on Broadway. Yeah. And, you know, and
well, off Broadway, aren't they?
No, but it shows corporate power.
Okay.
On the other hand, part of the Trump backlash, you know, we have this wedding cake case where people are arguing that they shouldn't have to sell a wedding cake to a gay couple if it violates their religious views. And this has actually made it to the Supreme Court because we now have some really freaky right-wing nut cases on the Supreme Court. And this case, which should have been dismissed, is actually being heard. So there is this threatening backlash. And of course, there's a huge anti-trans campaign that's, you know, based on, they're trying to pass laws against trans people.
We had a very similar cake thing in Northern Ireland, a case around a cake.
I wonder why cake is the thing.
Why is cake the fault line? It's cake the queer fault line. Right. It's your new book. Right. What is your overview of where it's going for LGBT and particularly trans people in America at the moment?
Well, I think that the biggest, I mean, it's, first of all, it's very hard to say what's going to happen in America because it's so crazy. You know, I mean, are we even going to live through this? We don't know. But I think that, you know, the real big issues for queer people in America right now is poverty. And we're looking at, you know, undocumented gay people, immigrant gay people, Muslim gay people, people who are experiencing profound oppression because of racism. And then on top of that, have all of the problems of being queer in the United States and trans. And this is they're like the new abject object, the new queer, whereas the old fashioned gay person is in a much better boat. But maybe that will change as well.
And do you see the LGBT community rallying around the new queer?
Well, some people are. I mean, there's it's interesting, like if you look at Black Lives Matter, which was started by queer women, and if you read their manifesto, they mention queer, trans, and HIV in the first paragraph. So we're seeing a queer inclusive black movement. You know, and yeah. Certainly Palestine Solidarity Movement is queer inclusive, and the Dreamers are queer inclusive. So in a sense, the new movements that are emerging are queer inclusive. So in a sense, there's not this need for a separate gay movement. I mean, one thing that I think people have forgotten is that the reason we had a separate gay movement was because nobody else would have us. It's not because we wanted to be separate.
You weren't the ones allowing you in the gang.
That's right. Yeah. We couldn't get in coalitions, and everybody, even on the left and the feminist movement, was homophobic. You know, now it's much more integrated. So perhaps it doesn't have to be a separate movement.
Okay. You have a new novel out in September.
Yes, and yes, it's a murder mystery. Oh. It's called Maggie Terry. It's a novel of murder and intrigue. You know, my last two books, I wrote this novel called The Cosmopolitans, and yes. I'm very, very proud of. And
that has kind of overlaps with your nonfiction as well,
yes.
In terms of what it's about.
It's set in Greenwich Village whiteness. In 1958, yeah. And I think I really did a good job. I have to say that's a book I'm really proud of. But good. That took a lot out of me. It took me 13 years to write that one.
Wow.
It's a really good novel. You know, it's like a page turner. And then I wrote Conflict Is Not Abuse, which was like my magnum opus. And after that, I was so like, my brain hurt. I was like, Sarah, stop with the gravitas already. So I just sat down and wrote this like murder mystery, you know, because I just needed to do something that people could read on the beach. So that's coming out.
How long did it take to write?
I think about 2 years.
And is there undertones or underpinnings of activism and social justice in it?
Well, there is.
You can't.
Because
there always is.
The thing is, I teach in a public university on Staten Island, which is a working class enclave of New York. And in that particular school, there's a lot of police officers going to school. So for 20 years, I've had students who are police officers and prison guards and this sort of thing and Trump supporters. And I've learned quite a bit about their point of view. So this book, even though it's a police detective, there is a lot. It's very much influenced by what I've learned by working with police officers.
Well, I look forward to reading it and see the movie, maybe.
I hope so.
You teach Audre Lorde's essay, The Transformation of Silence into Language and Action, and you say it works with all your students. Why does it work?
There's something about telling people your silence will not protect you that everyone knows is true. Okay. It's the one universal thing that I can bring in class and every single person can connect to it. You know, Audrey was my college professor at Hunter College,
yes.
So I have a personal connection.
Yeah.
And I try to keep her work alive.
Tell me about your memories of her, of your first with her.
It was at Hunter College, which is CUNY. It's the same public university system that I teach in now. And the class was called U.S. Literature After World War II, the most banal title possible. So she walked in the first day, and at that point she had had her first breast cancer, but she refused to wear a prosthesis. So she walked in the first day, she had one breast, and on the other side she had all this jewelry hanging down her shirt. And she said, we're changing the name of this class to The Poet as Outsider. This was 1982. And the three required texts were Black poetry, Native American poetry, and lesbian poetry. So she had the students had to carry this book called Lesbian Poetry on the subway in 1982. So she was, I learned a lot from her, especially about how to teach in a large public classroom where you have 30 or 35 students. I use her method now.
Okay. And speaking of lesbian books, can you talk to me about who are the queer women writers that you think are bubbling up now to the surface?
Oh, there's so many. There's Shavisa Woods, who is writes from a white working class point of view, whose work I really like. I'll tell you that there's a gender queer female writer named Matilda Bernstein Sycamore, who has a new book called Sketch to See that is incredible. It's coming out next year. It's about like queer, trans, drag, hustler, ecstasy scene in the 80s, but it's so well written. I mean, this book takes you like you're on the dance floor in this book.
Oh,
like you're tripping out on this book. It's one of the, it's so well written. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, I'm very excited about that too, but I'm also very excited about your novel, your new novel. And it was very exciting to meet you today. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. I've been talking to Sarah Shulman as part of the Q&A Queer and Alternative podcast for GCN. You can find us on everywhere the podcasts are published. And please like us and rate us and tell your friends. And we'll see you next time.